This week on the Finding Impact podcast, we're helping those younger founders out there with the unique challenges they face with Lamia Makar of Haiti Hands-On.
FindingImpact.com. FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.
Hey everyone, my name is Andy Narocott. I'm the founder of Finding Impact, the show with an audience of social entrepreneurs meeting the planet with solutions to its many challenges, from providing jobs to disaffected youth to recycling waste so waste becomes a thing of the past. This podcast is to help them on their important journey. The goal of this particular episode and several that we're going to do like it is to look at the unique challenges facing young entrepreneurs. It's researched and put together by Jolene Imani, who is a young social entrepreneur herself, who asked the following. How can I be taken seriously by professionals and people who are older than me? I feel like I easily get dismissed whenever I was talking about my ideas because I'm young. I would like to have professionals in my team, but how do I convince them to work with me? And how will I be able to maintain a respectful relationship despite the age difference? I think I would really benefit from hearing the experiences of young entrepreneurs and how they were able to succeed in recruiting team members who are older and more experienced, and what challenges they faced because of their age and how they were able to overcome these challenges. So that's from Jolene. Thanks very much, Jolene, and for all the research you've done. Well, first up, we have Lamia Makar, who has overcome many challenges of being a young founder. She's prolific, having started at 13, and we're going to hear her story now and some of those tips that she's got for other young entrepreneurs. I hope you enjoy it. Remember to check out the show notes at findingimpact.com, episode 119. Ladies and gents, I give you Lamia Makar. Hey, everyone. I've got Lamia Makar here, and we're going to talk about Lamia's experience as a young founder with the hope of inspiring and helping other young founders succeed at what they're doing. So Lamia started her first nonprofit, Haiti Hands-On, at the age of 13, when at times she had to skip school and present to CEOs in boardrooms, right? So, and this was in the UAE as well, which is, you know, which is maybe even more challenged, nuanced for that specific context as a young person going into a very male-dominated environment. But fast forward to today, 8 years later, and Lamia has kindly come on to share her experience, and I'm really excited about this, and hopefully this is going to inspire and help so many more young founders. So Lamia, welcome onto the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me as well.
So tell us, let's get some of the backstory about, you know, when you were 13 and you started out with your co-founder. Can you give us a sense of why you did that? How that came about? Why does a 13-year-old decide to set up a nonprofit?
Fair question. And the question I get the most often. I mean, to be totally clear, my best friend and I had no intention of starting a nonprofit or anything like that. It really just started as you know, two young girls who were, as you said, in the UAE at the time. And my best friend, her name is Taz. And we were talking about the fact that she was Haitian American, but had never been to Haiti before, and kind of that experience. So really, this had first started out as us wanting to do a sort of cultural exchange trip and to try to explore, like, what is Haiti? What does it mean to be Haitian for her own heritage? So we just like started a small club at our school called Haiti Hands-On, just to raise money to go to Haiti to do this cultural exchange. But it was through that process and actually being there and in the experience that we had over that summer there, since we were very explicit about like not wanting to be, for example, like in a hotel in the city, but actually wanting to immerse ourselves into a community. So we went and spent that summer in a rural community up in the mountains and having like one-on-one dialogues and so on. And what we realized was that, you know, everyone had the solutions to their problems. Everyone knew exactly what they needed. Everyone was telling us that like education is the key to development and that's what they need to succeed. But they just didn't have any access to the resources to try and make those realities happen, right? So it had really just started as, you know, being very simply like a 13-year-old looking at the issue and being like, okay, you have people here who have solutions and you have people back home in the UAE who have maybe resources to help make those solutions happen. So why not just connect the two? And it was in that connection process that we then like became a nonprofit and co-created the first school with that community. So fast forward, as you said, 8 years later, we now have the first school in the community, and it's a community-owned school, and we have 175 students and growing every year.
Wow, amazing. And so it all started out as this cultural exchange trip. I mean, was that sort of your own idea, or was this something to do with schoolwork, or was it an idea that was planted by, you know, a family member or something?
No, it was quite the contrary, not our family's desire whatsoever. But it was more so just, you know, us talking about, I'm French and Egyptian, and I'm lucky enough to have been raised in a household that was like very much French and Egyptian, and speaking both languages and like experiencing both cultures. So in talking with my best friend, we were realizing that, you know, she didn't necessarily have that same privilege. Like, she knew her mother's heritage was from Haiti, but she didn't necessarily know very much about Haiti. And she had family members who had gone and things like that, but she had never. So it was really more just an interest of like, let's try to explore that part of who you are, and try to understand that.
But did you have some really supportive parents to sort of support? Did they come with you to Haiti in the first place?
My parents did not. I think now, obviously, I do understand it. It was a little bit frustrating at the time, but I think it's quite normal for parents to not want their 13-year-old child to go alone halfway across the world to a country they've never been to. So, you know, it was like a very big hesitation on their part. But in the end, like, since we had raised the money ourselves to go, and since I remember like doing a presentation for the first time we left with my parents, like, this is where we're going, this is why we're going, this is who we're going with, this is how we're getting there, how you can contact me, like every single detail that I could possibly put into a presentation, and I like pitched it to them basically. And they were extremely hesitant, but at the end of the day, like, we had raised the money ourselves to go. So a bit to their dismay, I'm sure, we did end up going. And I think it was a bit to their dismay as well to realize that every time we came back, we're like, no, we're going to go back again. And obviously that's not out of like lack of support for what we were doing, but obviously just like fear of having your child halfway across the world with people you don't know. It's understandable.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. Just, you know, you pitched your parents. I mean, that's like the first fundraising round, you know, the first pitch at 30. I mean, yeah, my 30.
I mean, I really didn't recognize that it was a pitch at the time, right? For me, it was just like, what can I possibly do to convince them? I think I put together a little packet as well.
Amazing.
Like with like everyone's numbers and like, where's the nearest hospital? Where's the nearest police? Like, just trying to be as thorough as possible to just squeeze the yes out of them. But
amazing. So this is sort of great context. And, you know, you obviously was completely driven as a 13-year-old, and you kind of were, I mean, that's obviously stands you in good stead for a lot of the challenges that would come your way. I mean, can we just, I want to focus on that to talk about some of those big challenges. I mean, first of all, let's talk about your age, right? So there's going to be so many barriers simply because you're 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 when you've got this nonprofit. Yeah. Can we start exploring some of that? I mean, what's some of those challenges that you had to overcome?
Yeah, I think most simply, right, like just in the very basics of being able to have the proper infrastructure to run an organization, I couldn't open a bank account under my own name until I was 18. I couldn't register like a 501c3 in the United States, a nonprofit in the United States, under my own name until I was 18. There were a lot of barriers kind of in that sense of just like, how do you make things work as sort of a club organization while still getting the, like, being official enough and having like the validity of being recognized by serious stakeholders while still not being able to register these things, right? So that was like, definitely, we had a very much of a weird period in the first few years of like, how do we function this as an organization without necessarily having the proper documentation or the proper, like the more common channels of making this happen. But I think above all else, when it came to age, there was definitely an advantage in some senses, but the disadvantage was maybe just mostly in terms of getting people to take you seriously. And what that means for the ability to mobilize resources, the ability to raise funds, the ability to even like forget the UAE side, like even in Haiti, get community members to trust us and take us seriously and to understand like, oh, they're serious about their word. They're not just saying this because like, you know, they feel like they have to do something. So it was really a matter of like, how do you get yourself taken seriously and how do you prove to people that you're actually doing this?
Yeah. So there's these sort of impacts, structural impacts in a way, sort of bank accounts and 501c3 and things like that. So, and then there was these sort of social barriers of, you know, not being taken seriously as a young teenager. I mean,
which obviously affected everything else, right? Affects the economic side, affects like how we were able to fundraise and you know, so on.
Yeah. I mean, did you get any opposition from your parents as well?
Absolutely. I mean, right, like there was a whole conversation at the beginning as well of like just the stigma or the like global narrative around like Haiti specifically, of, you know, it's not like everyone trying to tell me that it's not safe to go there. You shouldn't be going there alone. Like you have no idea what could happen to you. Like people were telling me about kidnappings and murders and like all these things that were happening. And I just like, before I even went, right, my mindset was just, you know, I just couldn't help but feel like it's a bit hypocritical coming from, you know, us like Egyptians, from the Middle East, like living in the UAE. The entire world already has such a negative like stigma towards our countries of like us all being terrorists and it's not safe to go and like so on and so forth. So how could we project that onto another culture without actually having been there before, right? And no one who was telling me these things had actually been to Haiti before. I hadn't met anyone who had been to Haiti before going to Haiti, right? So it was really a matter of just like wanting to prove the point of, let me just get there and see for myself. And if there's an issue, all right, I leave. If there isn't an issue, like I'll stay. And, you know, thank God I did, because it's absolutely the total opposite of the things that I was hearing. It's a really wonderful and beautiful place. Of course, a place that still has many challenges even currently. But I think that that's true about most countries. So, I mean, the pushback from my parents on the one hand was definitely about safety and about like not wanting, you know, as I said earlier, to send your child halfway across the world. But then there was also this like flip side pushback, which was from my teachers, from, you know, my school principals, from my parents and from, you know, many other people in my life, that I was quite a like involved young person. I was, you know, in doing sports as well. I was, you know, very engaged in school and other things as well. So everyone was just kind of like, you don't need to be adding this to your plate, like calm down. It's okay. You don't need to be doing all of this. So it was like, on the flip side was also this kind of like worry for, does she actually know what she's doing? Did she like bite off more than she can chew? Maybe she should just like do less. Right.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that I didn't listen.
Absolutely. I mean, but you have to be strong in that, in the mind to do that. You mentioned mindset earlier. I mean, did you doubt yourself at all as well in that period?
I mean, there's definitely self-doubt, but not to the point of, I think there was only one moment where I like actually considered maybe quitting. And that was like nothing to do with anything that was happening on the UAE side. It was more just like complications in Haiti and like when things just got really complicated during the construction and so on and so forth. And when it was pushed back from certain community members, and there was just kind of a bit of a, you know, like having to deal with the social relations in Haiti. But I definitely had self-doubt in the sense that, you know, it's very, and I think this is where being young maybe worked to our advantage. Like, obviously you're going to doubt what you're doing because I've never done this before. And, you know, I've never learned like, you know, how to build an organization or how to build a school or how to do any of these things, how to write business plans. That was never something that I had any experience with before. So obviously there was self-doubt, but why I'm saying being young helped me is because I think at that age, you don't have the kind of like social stigma of not being able to say like, I don't know. Right. So since we were so young, it was very easy for us to go around and like just ask questions. We asked other organizations, like, how are you able to do this? Like, talk to us about your processes. We interviewed so many different NGOs before we actually started building anything. When we came to a point where we didn't know what we were doing, we could easily, you know, just call up somebody in our network or try to reach out to somebody and be like, hey, we're just like 2 15-year-olds are trying to do this. I don't know how to do it. Right. And I think that that's where being young served us, because many people were willing to share, like, you know, immense amounts of information. Even like we had contacts in the UNDP in Haiti and things like that, that were just like, you know, sharing a lot of insights with us that I don't think we would have been able to get had we been not only older, just because maybe we would have been in a position of like being able to admit that we don't know, because it would have been like a matter of us building our careers, which this wasn't for us at our age. And because people were maybe a little bit more hesitant to share information with like what could potentially be a competitor in the field, right? So I think that that's where it actually served us, that we were able to actually answer our questions about our doubt and just admit that very openly.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about those, that, you know, reaching out to people, because that's, I would imagine, you know, yeah, it's an advantage, and, you know, young people do it, take advantage of that, because people don't see you as a competitor, or, you know, don't be afraid to ask because, you know, you're in the right position. But give us some sort of tips and tactics when just reaching out to people and asking questions, asking the right questions, obviously, and who to reach out to.
Yeah. I mean, first, when we were first like considering, okay, are we actually going to do this? It was a lot of just researching different nonprofits that were working in Haiti, as well as different education nonprofits that were working anywhere in the world. And that was just like through Google searches or through like networks at our school or through, you know, different organizations or things that other people had volunteered at or had relationships with our school in the UAE. So that was really just like researching, writing cold emails.
A lot of cold emails. Now, then.
Yeah. Yeah. And in retrospect, poorly, probably like too long and too, like now that I've learned more about like reaching out and cold emails and the power of LinkedIn and all these things, it maybe wasn't the most effective avenue forward, but it definitely, I think that you have to accept that like you have to learn as you go. So the first ones are probably not going to be the greatest, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of cold emails for that category. And then when it came to, and that was just a lot of asking of like, how do you do what you do? What does that look like? And so on. Then when it came to actually like looking for potential partners, right? It really was as simple as, and I think we were just lucky that this is what the organization was called. But we actually looked up Haiti School Project. Just to see who was working on education projects and who could we potentially maybe partner with or ask more questions to. And our partner that ended up doing the construction with us is an organization that is exactly called Haiti School Project. So they were the first one that came up. There was a YouTube video. We watched the video. We were engaged. We reached out to them. They answered. And since then, we ended up working together for 4 or 5 years. So that was a lucky hit, I guess. But yeah. The one that actually scared me the most was reaching out to potential donors, corporates, things like that in the UAE. And I remember this just so vividly, like the concept of, so I, you know, Googled like how to write a business plan, how to put together a proposal, things like that. And I had put together a basic proposal and a basic business plan, had drafted a few emails. And my strategy was essentially, all right, I'm going to send this by email. I'm going to get the phone number for the company. I'm going to call the company. Once I talk to somebody like higher up, I'm going to fax them a copy of the proposal as well. And I remember writing out a script. I was so nervous about doing phone calls. And I was like, oh my gosh, like right away, they're going to know that, that I'm so young. They're not going to take me seriously. Like, how do I sound older on the phone? Like, yeah. How do I sound professional? So I remember writing out a script and like potential answers that I would get and potential answers that I would give to that, and practicing it over and over and over again and sitting on the floor by the fax machine with like a spreadsheet of people that I was going to call and just taking a deep breath, dialing the number, doing the call. Some of them worked, some okay, like just moving down the spreadsheet, but between each call I would just like have to pause and like practice it again because I was just so nervous about that.
amazing. So there's some really good tactics there about, you know, putting on a more business-like voice or something on the phone. But any other tactics for, you know, trying to overcome some of those age stereotypes?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, like at the end of the day, what served for us was getting people to really understand your why and getting people to understand that you're serious to the point that they were no longer looking at our age, but they were actually looking at what we were doing. Right. So on the side of the community that we were working in Haiti, that was really a matter of like spending a lot of time with community members, talking to them, really getting them to understand our intentions, getting them to understand why we're doing what we're doing, why this is important to us, really building a culture of trust on that end. And then in the UAE and then in other markets where we were fundraising, it was really a matter of getting people to understand that before they could even ask us, how old are you, getting them to understand that like this is something that's already happening, right? So getting them to see that, oh, when they talk about building a school, they're actually talking about building a school. They have proof of it and like they have a track record with it and they've started something actually. And I noticed that once we were able to have that proof and show that story and like be very clear about that, people stopped caring how old you were, at least to a certain extent. And that, I think that would be my tidbit, right? For anybody who's trying to do this, is spend less time worrying about how people will perceive your age and just start doing it to the point that they're no longer asking about your age. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, get over that initial sort of, bias. It's certainly disappears as soon as you probably start talking quite passionately about your project. Yeah, right?
Exactly. If people know how much you care, then they're not going to care about, you know, the less important details.
Yeah. And what are some of the, let's go on from age, you know, when you're raising funds, any sort of impediments that you could suggest, you know, talk about there, some of the challenges and things that you had to come.
So, I mean, when we first came back from Haiti the first time, so we had decided, all right, we're going to co-create this school with the community. We had done all this like research and interviews with different nonprofits. We were continuing to do that. And then we were like, okay, well, we need the funds to do this. The maybe like easiest avenue would be to get larger sums of money than just small donations from corporations. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's when, you know, I figured out how to write a business plan, figured out how to write a proposal. In retrospect, again, maybe not my best work at the time, but you have to start somewhere. So figured out how to write these things and started a spreadsheet essentially of all companies in the UAE that had some kind of like CSR program, and had a spreadsheet with, you know, their names, somebody who worked at the company, if I could find it online, and a phone number. And I went through this process of, you know, sending in a cold email, calling, trying to talk to somebody in the organization or in the company. And then once I did, letting them know that I'm faxing them a proposal right away. That process was like a huge learning process for me as well, because I'd never done anything like that. But we did actually manage to get a few meetings out of that process. So I think the first year we had maybe 3 or 4 meetings in these corporates where they're like, yeah, come tell us about your project and we'll see if you're eligible for some of our CSR funding. So I went into these meetings, and this was our very first year. So at the time, I think I was 14. And, you know, I was pitching the project, but this is what I was talking about, right? Like everyone automatically was looking at our age, and we didn't have any proof of anything that we were actually building yet, of course, because we had just started with the idea. So the response that we were getting, and this was just a pet peeve of mine growing up, was a response of, oh, good for you. Oh, that's so cute. It's cute that you really want to get engaged. Like, you know, it was a bit of a condescending tone in a sense of like how adults talk down to children sometimes, of just, you know, like, good for you. Like, you'll do great. But obviously no kind of backing or actual, you know, support in terms of CSR funding or connection to other people or anything like that. So we realized, all right, we might have to do this a different way. So we decided, all right, the first year we decided to do it kind of in a non-conventional way, especially since we didn't have any kind of, as I was talking about, structure of an organization or something that we could, you know, solicit donations for. Soliciting donations online as well is illegal in the UAE. So there were a couple barriers in that sense. So we actually ended up raising our first $100,000 through babysitting, tutoring, planning birthday parties, events at our school, bake sales, things like that. We kind of got a network of other students as well.
$100,000.
Yes.
Wow.
that was over 2 years.
Wow. Amazing.
You know, we had a network of other students who they needed service hours for the school. So they would go do tutoring for us and we would take the money and they would get their hours. So like everyone had, you know, was benefiting in their own way. And then we used at least the initial $50,000 that we had the first year to actually go back to Haiti and start the construction. And we just recorded, you know, a lot of pictures and videos and interviews and so on during that initial phase, so that we went back actually to some of the same corporates and other ones as well the following year with all of that proof, to the point that, as I was saying, the conversation was no longer about like, oh, how old are you? Oh, that's cute. It's now a matter of like, oh, they're actually doing something. This is so interesting. Yeah. Like, how can we get involved? It's such an easy way. Like, they have a track record of actually making this work. So it's just easy to, for them, what small money, like, you know, 5,000 or 10,000 or whatever, for us was huge. That was like, in the matter of one meeting, you're getting the amount that we would get from like 2 months of nonstop fundraising, like with two events. So that, you know, we ended up raising about, I think about $35,000 or $40,000 that way as well, which was just, you know, like one guy, I remember the first one just handed me an envelope with US dollars with cash in it.
Oh my God.
For the organization. And I was, you know, I was standing there outside the office, like as a 15-year-old holding this like packet of money. And I was like, what is going on? Like, this is like, it just got so real for me, you know? Yeah. And it, obviously I was like freaking out and so happy that it had worked and so on. But that's what I was saying earlier, right? Like, as soon as you get people to, are able to show people kind of that side of it, they're not going to care as much. Nobody in that second round asked me like, how old are you? Or so on. Like, you know, it was more a matter of, okay, she's young, but obviously she should be probably old enough that she's able to do this. So it doesn't really matter how old she is. Right.
Yeah.
So that was a good change.
Brilliant. So I love that. So get the proof point in there and sort of, it's the sort of old fund, you know, primary funding round, I suppose, a traditional one being family, friends and fools. This could, you know, include bake sales and babysitting as well. Amazing. And then you've got the proof point and you go out and then people know you're serious and then you can execute. So, that's a great piece of advice for others. I mean, you also hired people as well, right? So how the hell do you hire someone and manage them from at such a young age? I mean, this has got to be a big one.
Yeah. I think that was also my biggest, you know, my biggest wake up calls or what am I doing calls when I'm was in those situations and I'm just like, wow, okay, this person's like triple my age. Like, how do I think that's where a lot of the doubt came in as well, right? It's like, am I actually qualified enough to be doing this? And how do I actually go about doing this in a way, again, that my age isn't going to be a factor for them? Because I think a lot of people as well have issues working, I don't want to say for, like they weren't working for me, they were working for the organization, but like having maybe a supervisor or somebody that they have to report to who's that much younger than them. I think a lot of people had issues with that. In terms of just like, I don't know, maybe like just the social stigma around that.
Yeah.
So we were a very diverse team in the sense that even our main partner for Haiti School Project, right? So our main guy for construction was 74 years old. We were, you know, 15 or so. And then we had everything in between.
Can you give it just a sense so we can get context of, you know, when it started off with you and your co-founder, but then when did you add people and how much big did it grow to?
Yeah. So we had, I mean, right off the bat, one of our main people in the team as well, was somebody that we had met during our first trip, who was in his mid 20s, and he came on like more so as a member of the team and like support for, you know, operations and logistics. So that was kind of an easy partnership in the sense that like we had already known each other and he was involved kind of from the very beginning. We then together found Haiti School Project, which became a partner for construction in Haiti. And then it was a matter of, you know, and then obviously in the UAE, we had like a network of students that were helping us with fundraising, but that wasn't necessarily a matter of like hiring or anything. When it came to me writing my first contract, and in all fairness as well, a contract in Creole, which wasn't necessarily my best language yet, was a matter of, you know, hiring the construction workers, hiring our local coordinator, hiring other people that would actually oversee and manage the initial phase, which was construction and so on. So at that time, that was about 2015, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I was about 15. I was about 16. And that was a matter of, you know, writing these contracts, having them checked, obviously, for language and everything. But, you know, even just in terms of writing a contract, I'm like, how specific do you need to be? What do I need to include in this? Like, all of those were, you know, questions that I had. But again, I had the age benefit of like being able to contact another organization and be like, hey, do you have any sample contracts that you've used? And use some of those as like learning points as I was writing my own. And then it was a matter, I mean, some of it was fine in the sense that, you know, for example, like construction workers had to directly report to the local coordinator. So it wasn't so much of an issue for any of them. I also had a really great relationship with many of them as well. But it's true that, I mean, hiring was less of an issue as firing was, yeah. Unfortunately. And that was something that we had to deal with just in terms of, you know, some of the wrong people being hired. And I think that that's inevitable as well. Just in terms of, you know, and it's like a bit of a cliche, and I don't want to like perpetuate the cliche by saying that this will always be the case. But when there are, you know, big development projects in emerging markets, and when there are, you know, like a lot of money that's involved in things like that, if you aren't like directly bought into the vision of what's actually being constructed and see the direct benefit for the longevity of your community, then there might be, you know, incentive for you to cut corners and to maybe, you know, filter money off the top. And that was actually, ironically, the only two people that we had issues with were the only two people that we had hired who weren't from that community. So that I think speaks volumes as well to kind of the buy-in that different people had. So for me, my biggest issue wasn't the hiring. That was a matter of just like asking questions and seeing like who was reporting to who and how to structure that. But on the firing side, it was a matter of, you know, like, long story short, there was a fight between two construction workers that got really intense. One guy shows up with a machete to the work site. Another guy had, you know, laid voodoo powder outside the other guy's house. It became like a whole community issue. And obviously we had to let them go. And I was at this point where I was like, I'm firing two people who are a bit more than double my age. You know, I'm having to sit down and like, no matter how much money they stole or whatever, like I'm having to tell two people that have families and who have kids and who have, you know, like people that they need to support that they can no longer work for us. And, you know, it was just a little bit of I remember that day so vividly. It just like a little bit of a moral dilemma as well of, at the end of the day, like, what do I do and how do I deal with this? And how can I don't know, like, how can I seriously sit down somebody who's like in their 30s as a 16 or 17 year old and tell them that, like, you're gonna be let go, right? It's like, it's on the one side it's funny, but on the other side it was like
it's hard
but also like had me wondering, am I doing the wrong thing? Should I be keeping them on, right? But I think that that's a little bit of the self-doubt of like, no, at the end of the day they're doing a horrible job, they're stealing money, they, you know, they don't have the right to be working for this. But at the same time you still have this like self-doubt of, should I have the right to fire somebody like that?
And
that was very strange.
I can understand that, absolutely. I mean, I can also think it's hard for anyone. I suppose it's just doubly hard for you at that age. But it's an incredible learning opportunity, you know, and what an amazing learning thing it is going forward. But I want to move on just to get a couple more questions, and we're running out of time. But if I, because there's so much you're trying to learn at a young age, you know, contracts and hiring people and stuff. I'm just thinking about sources of information. You talk about, you know, cold calling almost, or ringing other organizations and ask, how did you do this? So if you could balance thinking about Googling information versus calling up people and organizations to ask, how did you do this? Or having regular advisors or people that you could speak to and knew you personally as well. What was the sort of balance and mix between sourcing that information, would you say?
I mean, I think in a sense, I'm grateful in that kind of the advisors that we had were the one partner that I had mentioned who had come on to our team. He was a huge, you know, source of help in the process. His name is Arnold, just in terms of like being, maybe having dealt with some of these things, not necessarily for his own organization or his own startup, but on the flip side, right, of being somebody who's received contracts, being somebody who's like been exposed to these things before. So he was definitely a huge advisor, and it was wonderful to have him like as integrated into the team. In terms of other advisors, though, I mean, obviously we had advisors at our school, just in terms of you know, people in our service program and so on, that were able to help give us direction for fundraising activities and how to do those kinds of things at school. But I really do think that the majority, in terms of like asking questions about how this is done and things like that, were through these cold calls and emails. So that was probably around, I don't know, I would say like 40% or so. The Googling came down a lot to like actually the nitty gritty things, like how do you open a bank account? How do you write a business plan? How do you like those kinds of more things where it was a matter of like, okay, I need to sit down and do this and I've never done it before. So that probably takes another 40%. And then the advisors and so on and conversations with them was about a 20%. I think that I had a lot more of like a social support system, just in terms of like people like checking in on me and making sure that I was okay, like as an individual, rather than like people who really knew very much about building schools or running organizations in my circle in the UAE. But I think that that's also like hugely important as well. So that's kind of my breakdown. Yeah.
Awesome. It's so important. We could talk for hours, but I want to finally close off with, what is your advice to others who are listening, who have an idea for service to their community or to other communities? You know, what are those sort of pieces of advice you'd give to them?
Yeah. I think that oftentimes, especially as young people and especially as people who our entire lives have heard that there are all these steps that we need to go through first, like we need to finish high school, we need to, you know, go to college, we need to get some experience at a job, we need to do all these other things before we can actually work on what we care about. I think that my advice is actually maybe just flipping that. Like, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. It's not like you can't work on these things and maybe go to school. And, you know, I'm in college now, like I did decide to go and so on. So I think that my main piece of advice is just, on the one hand, don't let your age stop you in that sense. And on the other hand, that you don't necessarily need to wait until you have all the experience in the world to actually start something, right? Mm. So I just encourage people to, you know, if you have an idea, understand that there's going to be a huge learning curve. Try to be as humble as you can in that learning process and, you know, ask as many questions as you can and try to not assume that you know everything, because in all reality, you don't. But don't let that stop you. So go out there and start learning. I mean, I've learned way more in this process over the last 8 years than I could have learned like in a 2-year degree about nonprofit management or something like that, right? Yeah. So don't always think that you need to have all the degrees and accreditation and all of the experience like working for other people and so on before you start. But also just be careful in the way that you're going about things to make sure that you're not, you know, causing harm and being detrimental by being careless with the assumption that you know what you're doing, right?
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Let me thank you so much for coming on. We're going to direct people to HaitiHandsOn.org if they want to find out more, but anywhere else you want to send folks?
I mean, I'm also always open as well on social media, mostly using Facebook or LinkedIn under my name, Lamim R. And then like, feel free to reach out, continue the conversation. I'm always happy to talk to people and to, I think also now serve as I still don't have all the answers, but to guide some people through some of the challenges that I had myself, because I've been there and I know how much it can help to have somebody who's like just very open and honest with you about what the process looks like. So definitely if there's questions or there's a want to continue the conversation, definitely reach out.
Amazing. It's been an honor. Thanks so much, Lamia.
Thank you.
And that was Lamia McCart of Haiti Hands-On. Thank you, Lamia, for coming on and sharing all of that you've learned over the years. I mean, you're still got so many years in front of you, but you've got so much experience already, and it's just incredible hearing your experience. And I'm hoping that inspires, and I'm sure it will, it inspires so many other young entrepreneurs, the Greta Thunbergs out there who want to take action, and you can, and your age is not a barrier. So get out there. Brilliant. Thanks everyone for listening. Thank you, Jolene, for putting this episode together. There's going to be more like it. Tune in soon. But that's it. Have a great week.
FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.